A generation or two or three ago, we left the farm for the big city. Yet today we sing, I'm gonna leave the city, got to get away. This leads us to ask, what will we find when we move back to the farm?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 520th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Luganville who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones. Hello, Carol.
Hello.
And also, producer Kelsey Olson is back from college. She's got to say hello. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Got it. Yeah, welcome back, Kels. Folks, listen to the lyrics. This is from Canned Heat. I'm going to leave the city, got to get away. I'm going to leave this city, got to get away. All this fussing and fighting, man, you know I sure can't stay. And this from John Denver. Country roads, take me home to the place I belong. West Virginia, mountain mama, take me home. Country roads. Okay, we've had it with the anthill madness of city life and we're going back to the country. But wait. What will we find when we move back to the farm? Here to help us find an answer, we have the sage of Dannebrog, Nebraska, and author of 40 Acres and a Fool, Roger Welsh. Roger, welcome to the Food Chain. Do I have you aboard here? Let's see. What am I missing? Are you there, Roger?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah, I was just reciting my Elton John lyrics. Should have listened to my old man going back to the plow.
Well, there's a number of songs like that. And, you know, last night I was coming back through the San Francisco Bay Area. The sun had set. It was dark. It was the top or the end of rush hour. There was 48 billion taillights out there to negotiate my way through from one end of the Bay Area to the other. And yet it was absolutely spectacular. You know, you could see the lights of San Francisco across the bay there, airplanes taking off, landing, and it was just a spectacular electronic anthill of life. And I called Roger Welsh in Dannebrog, Nebraska to remind him that we're going to do a show tomorrow. And his wife must have been listening to the phone message. At any rate, today when I heard your voice on the answering machine, Roger, I got to thinking, boy, I wish I was in Dannebrog, Nebraska, because I bet there isn't this madness going on there.
Well, they say that the rush hour in Dannebrog is when the Lutheran Church lets out on Sunday noon. And when we heard your message this morning on the machine, I thought, you know, if I had walked out to the highway here about 200 yards, I probably could have seen Jerry Blake's yard light about a quarter of a mile north.
Yeah.
It's pretty quiet out here.
Well, you know, and yet when your wife picked up the phone this morning, she said, oh, boy, I wish I could have been there with you to see those city lights.
Well, I carried her off from the city. One of the things we eat a lot of out here is buffalo meat. We love buffalo, and there's a herd not too far upstream from us. And she says that she loves buffalo so much that she wonders sometimes if maybe in a previous life she wasn't carried off by some brutal savage into the wilderness, sort of like now.
Uh-huh. There she is. Well, you know, it seems like those of us who live in this in the big anthill of cities look to the country and have this longing to go back. And is that what happened to you? I mean, you were a university professor, University of Nebraska, one of the nation's biggest and best colleges, and you chucked all that and moved to Dannebrog, Nebraska.
I walked away from a full professorship with tenure, which not very many people do.
What on earth led you to do that?
Well, I'm a folklorist. That was my training, and at the University of Nebraska, I taught in the English and Anthropology departments, and I was teaching traditional life, Native American, and especially frontier life. And I needed a retreat, and I bought this little piece of utter wasteland out here in the middle of nowhere on the banks of the Loup River. And essentially what I did was move from the classroom to my laboratory, because this is where I was getting my stories, this is where I was getting my information, this is what I was writing about. I had a column in Natural History magazine writing about ordinary life, and about the time we moved, I started writing for CBS Sunday Morning with Charles Kuralt,
right.
And he had told me to celebrate the ordinary, to tell the story of rural America.
How did Charles Kuralt find you?
Well, oh boy, there's a story. I had a lawn, and I lived in suburban Lincoln, Nebraska, which is not a city in terms of San Francisco, God right. knows, but it's kind of a city. But I was already interested in Native American traditions, Native American foods, and I found that they were eating things that we considered weeds. And I was bringing all these plants back and planting them in my yard. I had garbage cans buried underneath my rain downspout so I could grow marshy plants. And I came back from vacation one time, and I found that my lawn had been condemned by the city weed inspector, and I had 6 days to remove all worthless vegetation. So I had this guy come out and look at my lawn to tell me what was worthless, because I was eating it all. And finally I did what, thank God, we can still do in America. I ran for the Lancaster County Weed Control Authority on a pro-weed ticket. Well, Kuralt was coming through Nebraska he was speaking at a Nebraska Press Association meeting, and he asked somebody, I'd love to find out who it was, because I owe him big. He asked somebody at the table beside him if there was anything going on in Nebraska that might make a good story for his On the Road series, which he was in the middle of. And they said, yeah, there's a crackpot in Lincoln who's running for the weed board on a pro-weed ticket. So Charles and I got to be friends. He was something of a folklorist himself, after all. And we just got to really be close. And that's how I wound up then on Sunday Morning. He liked my writing, and mm-hmm. he liked what I was doing in the way of folklore research, and so I wound up for 13 years on Sunday Morning.
And he told you to celebrate the ordinary, and that's, of course, how he made his living.
That's right.
And that's what you're doing now, right?
That's exactly it. I bought this piece of ground out here and I found an old log house that had been built in 1872, oak and walnut, and I moved it out here to the banks of the river. And I told my wife, I said, every time I have to close that gate and come back to Lincoln, it gets harder and harder. And I said, sooner or later, you're going to have to get the highway patrol to come out and get me and drag me back to Lincoln, because it's just getting tougher. This little town at that time was 328 people, and so I knew everybody in the town. I loved the life out here, and eventually I decided this is where we had to live, and God bless Linda. She said, well, if that's what we have to do, that's what we have to do. So we came out here, and fortunately, with my work at CBS and as a writer, as things have changed through technology, now I can work just as easily with publishers or with radio broadcasters in San Francisco as I could if I were living in a city. And that's the big transition, is that now you don't have to farm. You don't have to take that enormous risk and immense investment and physical danger, as a matter of fact, of farming. If you want to live in the country, you can actually live in the country without being a farmer. You can be a writer. You can... one of my best friends is a computer programmer. He can do it just as easily from his piece of farm ground outside of Norfolk, Nebraska, as I can do here in Dannebrog.
Wow. So earlier today we were talking, you talked about coming out with 4 books this year. Let me ask you this. You know, when you were a university professor and a teacher, was it as easy to be a writer as it is now as a tree farmer in Dannebrog, Nebraska?
Well, it was a slightly different situation because, of course, in the academic world, you're expected to publish or perish, and you have to write things with a slightly different audience in mind, which is to say a professional audience, a scholarly audience. And I did a lot of books that were successful because they only sold 50 copies. You know, that's how you measure success in the academic world, is if you write something nobody reads. But fortunately, my field of folklore is the kind of thing that comes from the people, and therefore I felt an obligation to write for the people too. And my books at that time were Tall Tales and The Sod House in Nebraska, and I could write about serious subjects of research while at the same time making the information available to a popular audience. So it was not that hard a transition for me then to move over into writing books that were primarily for the general market. Mm-hmm. And I still like to think that a lot of the things I do are serious, like this, the book that you're looking at, right, which is about living in rural America. The other book that came out at just roughly the same time about edible wild foods here on the plains. Earlier than that, I had a book on, I'm interested in old tractors, so I did a book on introductions to restoration of old tractors. I've done books on dogs.
Well, you're just doing books like crazy. So the question is, are you more productive out there in the country than you were in the city?
Not a doubt about it, because here, I'm sitting here right now, and while I do understand the beauty of looking out across San Francisco Bay at all those lights, I'm sitting here looking out right now at about a quarter mile of Loop River frontage, and I can see, I had not right now, but deer walk by here, turkeys walk by here. We've had a mountain lion down in our river bottoms. I've got two black dogs sleeping out here in the sun. And there is a certain amount of tranquility that comes from it, but there's also the freedom. You know, I can get up and I can walk around. I've got a fire going out in my stove in the shop, so I can go out there and tinker a little bit this afternoon too and think about something else for a while, because that's
take your mind off, and that's probably the most important thing.
That's why I work with tractors, is because it's completely different from working with verbs and nouns. It's a nice distraction and a way to refresh my energies.
Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Roger Wells, the sage of Dannebrog, Nebraska. What do we city people want to move back to the country? That's what we're going to ask Roger when we get back, and I'm sure he has an answer, because he was one of those that had it made in the city and moved back to the country. But what is it about we city people that cause us to look with fondness to the notion of moving back to the country where our forebears came? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Michael Olson, we will be right back. Please do stay tuned.
Water users, you can reduce your need for water by 30% and more, grow healthier plants, and get rid of calcium carbonate deposits, no, not by magic, by installing an Aquamax catalytic converter in your water line that will induce epitaxial nucleation. Listen.
Hello, I'm Karen Coons. My father promised me that if I installed an Aquamax, I could grow grass where I've never been able to grow grass. And it's the truth. Was bare and spotty and is now deep-rooted and healthy. It's wonderful. We use much less water, and the plants look absolutely beautiful.
You can reduce your need for water by 30% and more, grow healthier plants, and eliminate calcium carbonate deposits just by installing an Aquamax on your water line. No chemicals, no filters. Explore the possibility. Go to metrofarm.com, click on the Aquamax Water Saver banner, and save. That's metrofarm.com.
We'll talk about having it made. What about being a tenured university professor, University of Nebraska, teaching something that has to be so much fun to teach, the anthropology of native foods in English to a bunch of bright-eyed students? And yet there's something that's just not quite working, something that's drawing you away from the city and out into the country, and so you cast your fate to the winds of Dannebrog, Nebraska, and leave all of that great security behind. So what is it about the country that is drawing we city people there? Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here today. We're talking with Roger Wells, the sage of Dannebrog, Nebraska. Roger, why did you chuck it all?
Well, I guess that would be hard to pin down, because mm-hmm. there were so many currents going on in my life, and it would be hard for me to pick
one. Well, is that
one.
It? Is it just city living getting too complex to live anymore?
Well, you hit the word right on the target, and that's complex, because we think of ourselves today as being in a very complex situation when the problem is actually exactly the opposite. We live in a very technologically complex world with computers, and I look around me here and I see a printer and a scanner and a TV set, none of which I know how to do anything with. If any of this stuff breaks down, I'm out of luck, because I don't know anything about it. It's complicated and it's technological, but it's not within my control. And that's what frustrates us. That's why we go camping. That's why we have RVs, and we go, because we want to be out away from this stuff over which we have no control. When we're camping, we build our own fire. We light our kerosene lantern. If we filled it, it'll burn through the night. We make our bed on the ground and we sleep there, and it's all within our control now. But it is more complex, because now we have to make our own entertainment. We have to entertain our kids and tell stories and sing songs around the fire. We have to make our own food out there around the fire. And around here, especially when I have my log cabin down by the river, I really do gather my own food, plums, wild plums, choke cherries, and that kind of thing. And so it is more complex to live in what we like to think of as the simple life, but it's a life over which we have some control. If I trim my wicks down in my kerosene lanterns and fill them with kerosene, I've got light that night. If I don't, I don't. If the lights go out up here on the house, I got to call an electrician, because I don't know what's going on, what's wrong. Mm-hmm. So what we're really seeking, I think, is not to escape the complexity, but to get our fingers back into a complexity that we can control. It's why I love old tractors.
I was going to ask what the difference was between, I know you love old tractors, you write books about them, you repair them, you become known worldwide as an expert at fixing old tractors. So what's the difference between fixing old tractors that have broken down and fixing a computer that has broken down?
Well, my car, I have a Taurus sitting out here, which is run apparently by a computer. I know that when I go in to have checked to see what's wrong with it, they plug in a computer to find out what's wrong with it. I look underneath that hood. I have no idea what's going on in there. There are all these wires and tubes, and I have the foggiest notion what goes on there. The tractors that I work with are 1930s Ellis Chalmers. They have four wires, one to each spark plug. That's the sum total of it. I can completely rebuild the engine on an Ellis Chalmers tractor in my shop with very simple tools and almost no problem at all. It's something I can see, I can understand, I can deal with. Again, it's highly complex. You got to know what you're doing to rebuild an engine, even on a 1936 tractor. But it's not the same thing as a computer in which I know absolutely nothing. And one of the things I love about after working in here is to go back out there, hone a cylinder, torque down a cap nut, you know, or something, just anything at all that I can see and understand and that I have some control over.
When you moved back to the country, did you find agriculture? What kind of agriculture did you find in Dannebrog,
Nebraska? Well, I do love agriculture. That's what Nebraska is about. You know, I always have to convince Nebraskans that football has nothing to do with the state. Our biggest campaign is harvest about this time of the year, and I just revel in it, Michael. And I drive back and forth out here, and I see the combines lurching around the fields and huge mountains of grain piled up. I realize the incredible wealth of this land and that we're feeding so many people, and including ourselves. And to me, that's the noblest pursuit on one hand, and it's also the greatest obscenity in America, that farmers have to have jobs in the city or factory, and their wives have to work to support the real job of making food. So I feel an enormous kinship with a farmer, although I'm not a farmer myself. I just don't have the courage to do that. I grow trees here on my farm. It's officially a tree farm, but I plant trees. If one of them dies,
well, wait
I've
a minute,
lost
wait a minute. You
a
said, Roger, you said you don't have the courage, and I'm not sure I understand that. What do you mean you don't have the courage to be a farmer?
If a farmer's crops fail, if he is hit by chinch bugs or hail or a windstorm or fire or whatever it is that takes the crop, or just rain at the wrong time, too much rain at the right time, then his wife's operation, his children's education, maybe even keeping the farm that's been in his family for three or four or five generations, is all at risk. And I don't have to do that here. I don't have to make a living off of this piece of ground. Essentially, it's a word farm. You know, my production is sitting here in my tin shed, looking out the window, and writing words. We were once up at the tavern with a couple of my buddies out here. One of them's a sheet metal worker, auto body worker, and one of them's a plumber. And they said, "How do you make a living writing?" And I said, "Well, I write for Successful Farming, and I get paid by the article there. I had done some writing for Esquire, and I said, and they pay me $2 a word." And they said, "So, like, every time you write the you get $2. And I said, yeah. And then my wife, Linda, who's the clever one in the family, she summed it up so nicely that I've always used it as an explanation of what I do for a living. She said, he can write the same words over and over, but he has to put them in different order every time.
There you go.
And I thought, oh, man, that's what I do. I take the same words and I put them in different order every time.
Did you see, what are the family farmers like that are left in the country? Do you meet them? Who are they and what are they like?
Well, it's an endangered species, that's for darn sure, because as I said, they have to work, usually the men have to work, or whoever it is who's the head of the family, sometimes that is the woman. They have to work another job to maintain the farm. Both of them are going to have to work, and God knows when harvest time comes, they both have to be out there working. But they are the real technologists of our society. My dad and Linda's dad worked in the Goodyear factory in Lincoln. And while you might think that that's the technological edge, it's like I was saying about camping and so forth. That's really nothing. My dad worked in a powerhouse, but he just threw switches and pulled levers, that kind of thing. Whereas out here, a farmer has to be an economist, a botanist, a chemist. He has to, a veterinarian. He really has to know, or she has to know, because increasingly there are women running farms too. They really have to be the diversified, technologically sophisticated people to run these enormous operations. But one of the things that's interesting, and it's what my book is about, 40 Acres and a Fool.
Who's the fool?
I guess that's me, but I think probably more it's the guy who doesn't come out and live on his 40 acres.
Well, can you hold that thought?
Sure.
When we get back, we'll pick it up right after this break. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here today. We're talking with Roger Welsh, who is the sage of Dannebrog, Nebraska, and author of 40 Acres and a Fool, and he being the self-confessed fool. But why is he a fool? That's what we're going to find out when we come back and talk a little bit about what we city people find when we go back to the country, what farming is like, what living on the land is like, what living with the land is like. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. If you care to jump aboard, I'd love to have you. Do stay tuned right back after these messages. Forty Acres and a Fool by Robert Welsh. Roger Welsh. Roger, I was cruising around in Webster Third once when I was preparing the text for my book, Metro Farm, and I came across, of course, the word farmer. And the third definition of farmer went something like this. Farmer 3A, ignorant, rustic, fool, crazy, stupid fellow. A green hand, inexperienced or incompetent at the trade at which he is working. As an English professor and anthropologist, where on earth did that come from?
Well, that's always been, and I think still is, the folklore of our nation, you know, the hee-haw image of,
right.
But the fact of the matter
aren't,
is...
Are you not kind of playing on that a little bit?
Yeah, because all farmers are. Mm-hmm. It's an age-old tradition in countries throughout Europe and probably all around the world. It's a very standard motif that the fool is actually the clever fool. And if you look at something like the Arkansas Traveler, where the city slicker's coming down the road, sees the farmer playing his fiddle on the front porch and starts asking him questions, you know, does this road go to Little Rock? And the farmer said, doesn't go anywhere. Lived here 40 years, never seen it go anywhere. Lived here all your life, farmer? Not yet. You know, it's really the city slicker who thinks he's smart who is the fool. And it's the farmer sitting on the porch who is the clever one. And I think that's still the situation today. We were talking before about this whole idea of why do people come out here, you know, what's it all about. America has a very interesting self-correcting system, I think, that when things get bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where there's suddenly nothing else available, that pretty soon when you can't find any beer except Budweiser, Miller's, and Coors, that's all there is, all at once, out of nowhere, every little town, including in a place like Nebraska, of all places, every little town has a microbrewery with interesting beers, new beers, experimental beers, local beers. And I see this happening in all kinds of fields, but especially in farming. Mm-hmm. As farms get bigger and bigger and more industrial and more complex and more petrochemically dependent and so forth, bigger and bigger and bigger, all at once, there were all these little acreages popping up with people like me living on a small plot of land, planting trees, but not really needing a profit on them, making my living as a writer, or people who are making a profit. A woman in Nebraska that we had started a story with CBS on before that series ended, but who runs a butterfly ranch.
Right.
She grows butterflies that are then released at weddings, anniversaries, celebrations, and all she does is propagate butterflies. There's a guy out here who grows milkweed, which is normally considered a weed and a pest, and he sells the fibers for fill on down comfort, down quotes, down close quotes, comforters and sleeping bags. There are all of these people starting to come up from the bottom with small pieces of ground where they don't have to mine the soil to grow more corn, to use up the water, to destroy the place, and instead they're using the same piece of ground to make a good living, a clean living, to do less damage and provide a genuine service and provide diversity. I'm excited by it because I think that the age of the big stuff may still be rolling on. The dinosaurs may still be there, but ultimately it's all us little crickets, you know, who are,
right.
who are creeping around the edge, and we're going to be the ones that survive the ice age.
Well, for years, you know, ag economists preached get big or get out, and so agriculture, like all industry, seemed to be growing in two directions, very, very big and very, very small. But I could never figure out how one farm with 10,000 acres is situated to satisfy the hunger of a metropolitan audience. It never, just does not make any sense. That
they can't even service their debt. A combine, Husker Harvest Days is one of the biggest agricultural shows in the nation, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's not too far away from my home here. And I was looking at a combine down there. It was $180,000. Well, how can you harvest enough corn to pay for $180,000 one piece of machinery? I'd worked at one point at the Living History Farms in Des Moines, Iowa, and they were developing at that time, this will give you some idea of when it was, they had a farm for 1810, about what it was like on the frontier, and then
right.
a farm for 1900 when they were transitioning between animal power and internal combustion engine steam power. And then they were looking at the farm for the future. And the future at that time, this dates me pretty badly, the future was 2000. And they said, what will be the farm of 2000? We're thinking, the people at the Ag College, of course, were thinking of the huge petrochemical, mm-hmm. industrial, agricultural farm. And I suggest that they do two farms for 2000. One would go to their big industrial, technological farm, but the other path would take you back to the farm for 1810, because that may very well be the future is the past. And I think that people like me who don't have to mine the soil and the water, but still produce something, in my case words, and the fuel trees, I'm doing a renewable fuel source called trees, we're doing a favor too, and we're doing a service, and this may be where the future lies.
And it might be a bright future at that. Let's go back to what people find, what we city people find when we move back to the farm, back to the country. What is it like living with nature? I mean, you know, we've got it made here in the city. You look at you know, driving through San Francisco last night, there wasn't much nature to be found. It was all electronic. It was brilliant. It was colorful. It was magical. But there wasn't much nature there.
Now, the most common comment I get is, boy, it sure must be quiet down there by the river. Well, no, it's peaceful, but it's not quiet. You know, when the coyote chorus comes through and sings something from a Bach oratorio down here by the river, you know, I sit up straight in bed, but I love the sound. The idea of there being wild dogs coursing through my place just excites me. We've had a mountain lion down here roar at night. We've got turkeys. There's owls. The geese were flying over yesterday, still heading south, and in the spring the cranes, sandhills cranes, fly over it so loud you can't hear yourself think. It is not quiet, but it is peaceful. It's a different kind of noise. It's a non-antagonistic, non-industrial kind of noise, not automobiles, and although there's an occasional grain truck out here on the highway too, you know, we get that, but it is a lovely place to live. I love living with nature, although Yeah, with Linda probably wouldn't be that enthusiastic about the occasional snake that shows up on the stairs. You know, they're harmless, but they nonetheless. Or the raccoon that got into the garage one time and tore things up. The skunk in the backyard. There are those kinds of things that you simply have to deal with because you're moving into their territory. In the book, I am not very kind to people who move out to the country and then are indignant about the smells of manure or the sounds of the cows or the bears in the backyard. You're moving into their territory, and you have to be prepared to adjust to that. It's not going to adjust to you. As long as you're in the rural country, you got to count on dust at harvest time because they're out there picking the corn. You got to count on the noise of combines in the field at night because when the weather is right, they have to bring those sheaves in. Yeah. And if that's at night with the combines roaring, well, so
that's
be it.
Just
you have to adjust to it.
Okay, when we get back, I want to find out about the people who live out there. Who do you meet? We city people have the benefit of being around millions of people, but what's it like out there where there are only a few people? We'll find out with Roger Wells. Do stay tuned. Right back. Well, a few years ago, I was headed to Monticello to do an edition of the Food Chain radio program, and I was driving up the highway and realized that I was going to be late, and I was not going to make it to all the way up to Monticello, so I pulled into the little town of Gum Springs, Virginia, and started looking for a telephone to hook up to and do my show. And I looked around, and there was a little Speedy Mart there, and I looked at that, and I thought, no, nah, not there. And I looked across the street, and there's a Hall's Automotive Engineering shop right there, and I thought, that might be it. And I went into the office and didn't see anybody around. There was a telephone sitting on the counter, and about 30 years of car magazines piled up there, and then I looked across, and there was a old geezer sitting next to a wood stove, kind of just sitting there, staying warm, and I said, sir, I need your phone. I just absolutely have to have it for an hour, and he said, what for, son? And he said, well, I have to do a radio show out there in California, and I need your phone. I just absolutely have to use it. And he looked at me, and he said, son, I never heard anything like that before. And that's the way these country people are. They kind of seem slow, but maybe it's us city people that are just too fast. Roger?
Oh, that's exactly right. When I lived in Lincoln, everybody in my neighborhood was of the same economic status because we all had houses of roughly the same price and so forth. When I taught at the university, everybody was of the same intellectual concern. We all had the same kinds of interests and concerns. But when I came out here, one of the things I discovered is that in a town of 350, you know the poorest guy in town, the Mexican day laborer, you know the richest guy in town, the banker, and there's not an inch's worth of difference in any of them. Dick Cabot was a classmate of mine, and we graduated together from high school, and he comes out here every once in a while, and he was kind enough to have me on his interview show when he had it in New York City. And he asked me about life out here, and I told him that same kind of thing, that out here, when the fire siren goes off to signal that somebody needs an ambulance, we have to know who that is. I want to know who it is that they're going for, whereas I suspect in San Francisco you don't ask that question. But I told him, I said that when I sit down for breakfast up at the Chew and Chat Cafe, I sit down with a banker, with a carpenter, with a farmer, with a town drunk. They're all at the same table. Well, Dick and nobody else probably in New York City knew who it was I was talking about. But here in Dannebrog, everybody laughed because I was talking about one guy. He was the banker. He was a carpenter. He was a town drunk. He was all of those things rolled into one. So we all have to fill our roles out here in the small town. But there's no escaping it. It's impossible to be a snob. I got an honorary doctorate one time at a university close here, and I told my friend Eric, who ran the tavern, I said, you know, I'm going to get this doctorate degree. Eric, do you suppose we can get the folks here in town to start calling me Dr. Welch? And he said, boy, Rog, it's taken me 15 years to get them to stop calling you lard ass. He said, it may be too early to get them to start calling you Dr. Welch. There's no such thing as snobbery in a town of 350.
Right. What about the humor? What about the country humor?
That's one of the reasons I came out here, Michael, was my interest is in the tall tale and in American folk humor, and it is so subtle. It's hard sometimes to know when they're kidding you. It's hard to know when they'll tell jokes.
Well, you know, when I was in that situation in Gum Springs, Virginia, and I was desperate for a phone, and this old codger looked up at me and, you know, oh, son, I had never heard anything that dumb before. You know, and it sounded like he was the rube, but, you know, when you look at it, I was definitely the one that was the rube there.
There's a poetry to it. One time again, up at the Chew and Chat Cafe, I came in there and it turned out that one of the young ladies here in town was pregnant. Somebody said, who do you suppose the father of that baby is? And Bumps Nielsen, who was Eric's dad and the real storyteller in town, said, that's like trying to guess which tooth on a buzzsaw hits the board first. Yeah, now that's pretty subtle, but it's also pretty funny. And it's poetry. I absolutely love that kind of humor. It's not sledgehammer humor like you sometimes hear on the Comedy Channel, but there's a remarkable subtlety and almost a literature to it, and very clever.
And very clever. Are they all very clever?
No, of course not. When a town of 350 is just like a big family, mm-hmm. there's the uncle that you're always embarrassed by if he shows up at the family picnic. There's the slow folks. And in fact, sometimes the slow folks are the best folks. They're the ones who think they're smarter than everybody else. You know, there's a little bit of everything. One of my best-selling books was called It's Not the End of the Earth, But You Can See It From Here, and it was sold as fiction to avoid lawsuits, but it was really about my little town of Dannebrog. And I had people calling me from all over America saying, I know what town you wrote that book about, because I grew up in that town in Pennsylvania,
right.
Florida,
or Montana,
California,
or Wyoming.
Because
yeah.
The characters are all the same. The whole spectrum, and the whole spectrum is always represented. It is a wonderful cast of characters straight out of Chaucer or Shakespeare.
Wow. Let's go to the phones right now. I've been hogging Roger Welsh all to myself. Sage of Dannebrog, Nebraska, author of 40 Acres and a Fool and a lot of other books. Let's go to the phones and talk with Rich. Rich, you're on the Food Chain with Roger Welsh, Michael Olson. Welcome and fire away.
Good morning. Well, the most important question I've been waiting all hour for is, did he win the election?
There's a reason they call me Landslide Welsh. I got more votes in Lancaster County than Jim Exon, who was running for the Senate, got in the same district. And somebody on the radio asked me what I thought about that. I said, well, it's just a good thing Jim Exon wasn't running for the weed board.
Because you could have gone on to be governor, and who knows what else, you know?
Well, I won two elections there, and at one point I was asked by some people to run for Congress, and I called up my mom, and I said, guess what, Mom? They want me to run for Congress. And she said, Roger, I raised you better than that. So I had to call him back and say I'd run for Congress, but my mother still thinks I might amount to something.
Sounds like you made the right decision anyway.
Yeah.
The question is, how many people have moved out there that you're aware of since you moved out there or that have done the same thing?
Gentlemen, we're going to have to pick that up when we come back from the break. Rich, can you hang on with us?
Well, that's fine. I'll hang up and let people phone, too.
Okay, good. Thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Michael Olson here with Roger Welsh, Sage of Dannebrog, Nebraska. Right back. Please do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, what about it? Rich wants to know if a lot of people have moved out into the country, like Roger Welsh. Roger, have there? You see a lot of people?
They sure have. The Sunday morning pieces attracted a lot of people because then they could see the landscape around here. The idea that Nebraska and the plains are flat was quickly blown away, as they can see that it's a beautifully defined topography. It's gorgeous country, and they're very nice people. But the population in Nebraska in general, especially out here in the western third that was homesteaded in 1904, has dropped steadily as people figured out you can't farm on a quarter section, a half section, a full section. And so the population has drifted out of the countryside and into the cities. But now people are starting to come back out, getting plots of 2 acres, 10 acres. I've got 60 acres here, despite what the title says.
Mm-hmm.
And I think more and more people are doing that. And in some ways, it's really the salvation of this landscape, because it's people who don't have to mine that ground and mine the water to make a living off of it.
Okay, good. Let's go to Kent really quickly, who has a story about small towns. Kent, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Kent.
I just wanted to share one of my favorite jokes, and I hope it didn't originally come from you. I have no idea where it came from. I grew up in a small town in western Iowa of 1,400, and so I read this somewhere that said, you know you're living in a small town when you don't have to use your turn signal because everybody knows which way you're going to go.
That's exactly right. I mean, one guy here, he always looked one direction when he went through the stop sign, but not the other, because he said everybody knows that I'm there at the same time every day, and they know that I don't look but one way, so what's the sense of it? And there was one old lady here who drives one of these great big battle wagons, you know, and she looks through the steering wheel. And she had trouble because she didn't know if the engine was running, so she just kept turning the starter and burning out her starters. So they solved it by knocking the muffler off of this enormous Cadillac. So you can hear this thing roaring like a jet from all over town. So everybody knows when she starts her car, and she knows when she starts her car.
That's great.
Well, it really does allow you to be whoever you want to be, doesn't it?
There is a lot of there's intolerance in small towns. There's racism here, definitely, but there is also a certain amount of you just don't have to care. You know, okay, if they don't like you, they don't have to, I don't make my living selling books in Dannebrog, Nebraska, God knows. So I can live my life as an author here without a lot of people being of particular concern. I can like the ones I like. I don't have to like the ones I don't like.
What is the most frightening thing you see about small town America?
It probably is racism, religious intolerance, and that is still pretty ugly. You hear people complaining one minute about how you no longer hear Danish in this very Danish town. Dannebrog is the name of the Danish flag. And then the next minute cussing because the Mexicans won't talk American. You know, well, gosh, I think that the Hispanic influence out here has been one of the best things that's happened to Nebraska in a long time, because it's brought color and interest and some new ideas where for a long time there weren't any. But more and more I see even that mellowing.
What about
I suppose that's the worst thing.
What about speed, methadrine?
That is a real problem, especially because the fertilizers people use out here, I guess, are part of the manufacture, and so there's a constant problem. But and when you see people's lives destroyed by speed, it's horrible. But yeah, I'm hoping that that's a passing thing, that as they get some of the ingredients under control, and as it destroys those who think that it's a great idea, that we won't have to deal with that very much longer.
What is the single most important thing for we city people to think about when we think about moving to the country?
I think that there is a country, that what you're looking for is what is here, and you can't change it to what you want. You have to be sure that what you want is what's already there. You're not going to change it to fit the old patterns. You're the one who's going to have to adjust. It is an anthropological experience. You are not simply changing neighborhoods. You are moving into a new society just as surely as if you were moving to South America. And you have to be prepared to make those kinds of adjustments in your life and to determine those kinds of changes for your kids, too.
Gee, Roger Welsh, I could do 30 hours in a row with you sometime. I want to thank you for joining us today, and want to thank all of you out there for tuning in the Food Chain. Remember, you can always log on comments and whatnot on the forum page at metroforum.com. I want to thank Roger Welsh for joining us today from Dannebrog, Nebraska. And want to wish all of you a great week, and want you to tune in next week for some more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.